where online privacy stands right now, what's happening with international trade today, and robot-proof jobs, hopefully forever. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In San Francisco, I'm Molly Wood, sitting in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday, March 31st. Thank you for joining us. We begin today, as we always do on Fridays, with the weekly wrap, our look at the big economic news of the week. Joining me for that discussion, two of my favorites, Catherine Rempel from The Washington Post and Neela Richardson, chief economist from Redfin. Hello, rappers.
Hi, Molly.
All right. So just moments before we began this broadcast, the president signed two new executive orders dealing with international trade. Still a little bit less than a complete international trade overhaul. Catherine, you start. What do you make of this?
Yes, this is certainly far short of renegotiating NAFTA and many of the other big blockbuster promises that Trump made during the campaign. But that said, I think that's a good thing. Basically, from what we know about these executive orders so far, these are attempts to study the problem of why we have big trade deficits and why we might have some uncollected, anti-dumping duties, for example. And in fact, Wilbur Ross told reporters yesterday that, quote, we may conclude that no action needs to be taken, unquote. So this is basically an attempt to study the problem, and I am A-OK with leaving it at that.
Neela, same feeling. Trade abuses, certainly worth looking into.
You know, for a government that said that they were going to start, an administration that said that they were going to start running the government like a business, this is a very government way to start a problem, which is to commission a study. that's usually how it
fair,
goes. A study is
to
commissioned.
Be fair, it's also a very consultant way to start, which is not not foreign to the business environment.
This is true. Yes, that's usually contracted out as well. So we're already seeing that the Trump operation, even in trade policy, is looking a bit standard. Not only are the policies starting to look standard, the actual approach is looking standard. And I think these executive orders reflect that.
This week, Congress rolled back some privacy protections that would have kept consumers' web browsing history under their control. Neela, do you feel like this is the week that people suddenly realize that this information might be for sale?
I think it is. I mean, imagine that your browsing history can be given to the highest bidder in order to sell back to you goods and services, or hopefully that's the least nefarious thing that will happen from people looking at your browsing history. And so, yeah, this is a very big issue on how should the internet be regulated. We have been operating under the assumption that privacy matters, at least to some degree, in terms of how people search and how people use. That assumption is now being softened quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. Catherine, do you think, though, we've had Comcast and AT&T come out today reassuring consumers they have no plans to trample all over their customer data and sell it. Could privacy become a business differentiator?
Well, so long as these companies have monopolies in large parts of the country, then no, right? I mean, it's one thing to argue that, oh, this is no different from Google or Facebook or any of the many other companies that also find ways to monetize your behavior online, although not quite to the same degree we're talking about here. But at least, even if people make the choice to use those services, it is a choice. There are lots of consumers who only have the choice of one high-speed provider. So the idea that you could say, okay, I don't want to go with that ISP because they don't protect my data, I'll go with their competitor, is just ludicrous. You know, many consumers just don't have that option.
And Molly, I think Catherine's hitting on a great point that this could just be the first step in eroding some consumer protections when it comes to internet usage. And that bears watching.
Catherine Rempel and Neela Richardson, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks,
Molly.
On Wall Street today, consumer spending slows a little. Stocks do a little dance and a little lower. We will play the music when we do the numbers. You You just heard us talk about those new executive orders that President Trump signed dealing with international trade. Let's take a closer look. Specifically, they address an issue commonly known as dumping. They'll look into whether countries are unfairly subsidizing their goods and then dumping them here, and whether the U.S. is actually enforcing punitive duties when we find out the dumping is happening. From our bureau at Oregon Public Broadcasting, Mitchell Hartman has that one.
It's not clear yet precisely which countries or which imported products the administration will investigate, though history gives us a pretty good idea.
There's a whole set of usual characters.
Sharon O'Halloran is an economist at Columbia University.
They will go after China, different Asian countries for electronics, go after Mexico and some of the steel for agricultural inputs in which there's direct competition. They'll usually go after Canada for timber and lumber.
If unfair trade practices are found, the U.S. could move to impose countervailing duties to make imports more expensive and help U.S. companies compete. Though Gary Huffbauer at the Peterson Institute says countries accused of giving unfair subsidies to local companies are likely to throw the charge back at the U.S.
You don't have to go any further than North Carolina or Ohio or Pennsylvania. You can name any state in the union. Does things to attract companies.
Like giving them tax breaks, energy subsidies, and the list goes on. But Heidi Brock at the U.S. Aluminum Association says what China does, giving its companies cut-rate bank loans, cheap raw materials, distorts the market much more.
No federal-oriented programs subsidize the U.S. aluminum industry the way that China's industry has been encouraged and subsidized,
leading to plant closures and layoffs in the U.S., which is why Brock is encouraged by this new spotlight on how our biggest trading partners boost up their homegrown industries. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Now, here at Marketplace, we've been taking a lot of looks at trade. This week on our podcast, Make Me Smart, Kai Rizdahl and I looked at NAFTA in particular and all of the ways that trade from Canada and Mexico become part of the fabric of our lives. You can find that at marketplace.org/makemesmart. The Senate has blocked an Obama-era rule that allowed local governments to set up retirement savings accounts for workers. The program was already being rolled out in several states and would have been available to workers who don't have access to employer-sponsored plans. And the rollback comes as almost half of working-age households have not put any savings into a retirement account. Marketplace's Adam Allington reports.
The measure passed through the Senate by a single vote, 50-49, and effectively bars cities and states from creating their own retirement savings accounts. Sarah Gill is a legislative representative with AARP.
AARP is deeply disappointed with the Senate's decision to discourage local flexibility about workplace savings. And that's because we know that 55 million Americans don't have a way to save for retirement at work out of their regular paycheck.
Gill says those without access to workplace savings plans run the risk of relying exclusively on Social Security. Jeremy Smith is director of the Retirement Savings Initiative at the Aspen Institute. He points out that it's an odd position Republicans find themselves in, essentially arguing against states managing their own affairs.
If you're a state government looking at more and more of your citizens requiring services as they get older without enough money, you're trying to figure out ways to reduce it, right? And one of the big ways is to help people save more of their own money.
Republicans' main objection is the fact that the state plans are exempt from federal consumer protections.
These government-run plans do not have to be portable, nor do they have to permit workers to withdraw their savings at any time.
Republican Orrin Hatch says this would create a patchwork of conflicting plans, allowing states to sidestep pension law.
That require prudent pension investment practices and that ban kickbacks and self-dealing.
Democrats argue that the Republicans oppose the plan because it creates competition for the financial services industry. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
A member of the Federal Reserve Board of Governors took a trip to West Virginia this week. Fed Governor Jerome Powell wanted to see the economy of Trump voters firsthand and try to explain what the Fed can and cannot do to help them. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer caught up with Powell in Morgantown, West Virginia, and has this report.
Before he left for his West Virginia trip, Fed Governor Powell told me he accepted an invitation to visit Morgantown and speak at West Virginia University to hear firsthand how the state is coping with things like opioid addiction and unemployment, which is above 5% in West Virginia.
I thought it was very important to get out and understand what's going on in a part of the country that's not doing so well, even though at the national level, things are pretty good.
Now, the Fed can't create jobs. It's just responsible for monetary policy, that is, interest rates. Powell says he realizes people don't think a lot about the Federal Reserve or even know what it does.
People, broadly speaking, go on with their lives and don't pay a heck of a lot of attention to what the Fed can and can't do, and I think that's perfectly understandable.
You might think supporters of President Trump wouldn't like the Fed. Trump won almost 70% of the vote in West Virginia, and Trump vilified Fed Chair Janet Yellen on the campaign trail, accusing her of keeping interest rates low to help former President Obama. But the Trump voters I talked to about the Fed, they're indifferent.
I don't really know what they do. No, I really don't.
I don't know. I'm a dumb hillbilly that don't know much about that stuff.
That was homemaker Shannon Morris and retired coal miner Jim Miller, who, by the way, was just joking about being a dumb hillbilly. They're sitting in lawn chairs in the parking lot of a park in Fairmont, just south of Morgantown. They're part of a group that meets once a week, selling odds and ends out of the backs of their vehicles in sort of a communal yard sale. Liddell Owens is a couple of cars down from Morris and Miller. He's a general contractor and knows all about the Fed.
What I believe they do is they deal with the interest rates.
Owens watches interest rates like a hawk. He knows if they get too high, people won't take out loans for the home improvement projects he does. On the other hand, he knows interest rates can't stay low forever because inflation would get out of hand. He's already seeing prices go up at his local Family Dollar store.
And I have seen their prices go 20-30%. I mean, on everyday things, toilet paper, your paper towels, things of that nature, they have just been going gradually up and up and up.
I ask Owens what he would say to Fed Governor Powell if he met him.
I know there's a lot of people hurting.
Up in Morgantown, Allie Harrington has a similar message. She's a single mom, a student at a job training program in Morgantown run by a nonprofit called West Virginia Women Work. It trains women for construction jobs. Harrington takes a break to talk to me. She says she's looked for a full-time job for 4 years without success. Finally, she got a job working weekends at a Hobby Lobby store. She and her toddler son live with her parents. I ask, is she living paycheck to paycheck? Harrington's eyes well up as she answers.
I'm past paycheck to paycheck.
What do you mean by that?
Credit card debt, electric bills, everything bills.
Harrington's message for Powell, training programs like this one, which gets some federal money, are a great investment. I ask what this training opportunity means to her.
It means everything. I definitely wanted to turn everything around. I want to be able to support myself and my child.
Powell arrives at the training site as we're chatting.
Hello.
Hi, I'm Jay Powell.
Powell sits down in a classroom and asks the program's coordinator, Misty Nicholas, about the center and the local economy.
Do you want to know about the program?
Yeah, please.
Is that what you want?
And
okay.
The place. Who operates this?
Powell ends his day in Morgantown with a speech at the university on the history of the Federal Reserve. He emphasizes that the Fed is designed to balance out national and regional interests.
The Federal Reserve was not structured to be entirely private in its ownership and operation. It was also not structured to have a single headquarters in Washington or New York with branches across the country.
Powell was trying to make it clear that the Fed isn't just interested in what's happening on Wall Street and in the halls of Congress. It's also got its eye on places like Morgantown, West Virginia. In Morgantown, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Coming up?
Like 4 or 5 inches of mud. You couldn't see the street, just nothing but mud.
Government management means dealing with mud and many other disasters. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 65 points, 0.3% to close at 20,663. The NASDAQ fell 2 points, less than 0.1% to finish at 5,911. And the S&P 500 lost 5 points, 0.2% to close at 2,362. For the week, though, the Dow ticked up 0.3%, the S&P gained 0.8%, and the NASDAQ added 1.4%. It's the end of the month, too, but I'm going to skip straight to the numbers for the first quarter because it was a beauty. I feel like the music should change here. The Dow managed to carve its sixth consecutive win with a gain of 4.6%. The tech-heavy NASDAQ soared 9.8%, and the S&P fueled up 5.5%, its best quarter since 2015. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.38%, and you're listening to Marketplace.
All this month, we're asking you to tell a friend about a podcast they are going to love. Right now, think of a friend, your mom, or anybody you care about. What podcast would they really, really like to hear?
All right, you got that person in your head. Now go do it. Tell them about it in real life or on social media. And if they don't know about podcasts, show them how to download them. Please tell us what you recommended with the hashtag TryPod. That's TryPod. And thanks for spreading the word. This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. Floods, mudslides, tornadoes, a major fire and bridge collapse in Atlanta. More than a dozen major disasters have already hit the U.S. since President Trump took office. And disaster recovery involves several federal agencies. That raises a question. This administration has made its name promising major changes in federal management. Does that include government support after disaster strikes? Marketplace's Jed Kim has been looking into that.
Last summer, a few thousand acres of forest burned in the foothills above Duarte, a town just northeast of Los Angeles. Today, it's easy to snap off some of the charred remains of trees that still stand. The fire left loose soil, and when January's heavy rainstorms hit, it became mud and slid down into neighborhoods.
Like 4 or 5 inches of mud? You couldn't see the street, just nothing but mud.
Alex Hernandez works as a gardener in the area. He's happy to be back in business.
Well, we weren't able to work like for 2 weeks because of the mud.
Protective concrete barriers still line curbs here for blocks in case more rain brings more mud. Similar scenes played out all over Los Angeles County.
Damages through rainstorms, muds, damages to structures, buildings, or any particular type of asset each city or agency has.
Ivan Messiaen met me at the county's Office of Emergency Management.
We collect all that information and then we submit that to the state.
If the damage hits a certain amount, the state gets federal disaster status. That means help from FEMA and other agencies. LA County alone has topped $35 million in damage, and President Trump just signed a federal disaster declaration for California's January storms. The new administration has filled the top spots at some agencies involved in disaster recovery. Ben Carson at Housing and Urban Development, Linda McMahon at the Small Business Administration. But there's still no head of FEMA under Trump. Jeff Slegelmelch is deputy director of the National Center for Disaster Preparedness at Columbia University.
If a disaster strikes, the longer we don't have permanent leadership, the longer we're sort of using a temporary leadership instead of permanent leadership for these agencies, which has the potential to weaken our response, especially if it requires involvement of the White House and advocacy at that level.
The Obama administration took several months to name a FEMA leader in 2009, but it wasn't proposing the major government agency shakeups and cuts that the Trump administration wants. Slegelmilch says Trump has proposed $667 million in cuts to FEMA, but no one knows what that means yet.
And we're seeing a major change in the way that disaster preparedness is looked at, and there currently aren't permanent appointees in these key positions that actually have to operationalize that and advocate for that during the budgeting process.
The leader of FEMA for the past 8 years left after the election, something he'd planned no matter who won. Craig Fugate oversaw Hurricane Sandy recovery, the tornadoes in Joplin, more than 500 major disasters. He doesn't think Congress will pass big cuts to FEMA, and he stacked the agency with career employees before he left.
That was something that, you know, we built for the next team. And so from what I've seen and from what I'm watching, they're doing what really is nothing different than what we would have been doing.
So places hit by disaster, like L.A. County, are seeing money and help flow as usual, for now. But Fugate took one major cue from the Obama administration. He got FEMA thinking and planning for future disasters through the lens of climate change.
Our approach was, it's happened, it's happening, it's not going to get better anytime soon. how do we adapt to changing conditions faster than the disasters are occurring?
Now, there's a backpedal on all that. For example, a recent executive order takes away a FEMA rule that flooded buildings have to rebuild higher to account for sea level rise. Now, they can just be rebuilt the same. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
A common theme in the discussion of jobs and reviving the American economy is how much automation contributes to a lack of human job opportunities. Back in 2012, Marketplace Morning Report host David Brancaccio drove coast to coast tracking jobs lost to machines, software, and algorithms. That series was called Robots Ate My Job. But now, 5 years later, a more hopeful look at what humans can do about it. The new series is called Robot Proof Jobs, and it launches next week. Here's David with more. Hi, David.
Hey there.
All right. So tell me what you did for this series. Last time, for people who don't know, you drove around the country in a car by yourself with the goal of not talking to any human beings. What did you do this time for this series?
Well, this time it's robot-proof jobs. I'm looking for the jobs right now in America that are more resistant to the robot incursion. But 5 years ago, it was Robots Ate My Job. And part of the deal there was, could I make it from coast to coast, from sea to shining sea, without ever dealing with a human, transacting business with a human. So I got from the Atlantic to the Pacific because, you know, I was testing the idea that the U.S. economy may not need humans as much as it used to. And that is the direction that we may be headed.
So now we're on the hunt for places where the robots cannot intervene. What did you find? Are there robot-proof jobs?
Well, I mean, you can hear the inherent optimism in that question this time. We're drawing on some data put together by the McKinsey consulting firm that looked at just about every occupation in America and looked at the automation potential, looked at the pay, how many of these jobs are there in America. And I think it's a really interesting discussion. I mean, it's not all techie jobs. You don't just have to get a degree in one of the much vaunted STEM fields to be more protected. It could be some of the creative occupations. Musical composer. We went to Oberlin, Ohio, and met with a composer where the chances of robotization, according to the data, is zero. An occupational therapist in Chicago. That's not going to be a robot anytime soon. Teachers. And then you have a category of American worker where society may not be ready to allow a robot to do the job. Police officer, for instance. I don't think we're ready for that. What about robot judge? People say, no, I'm not going to be judged by a robot judge. But what about in an arbitration or a mediation? There's artificial intelligence being developed right now to test whether or not software can mete out justice as well as a human.
I appreciate the hope springs eternal element of the jobs that robots can't replace. Nevertheless, it seems like this is a big policy conversation right now in the United States, right? Do you feel like with the conversations about globalization, trade, bringing jobs back from overseas, that the question of automation is being overlooked?
Yes, it's the discussion that's not happening. We're focusing on globalization, and that may be the story of the last 30 years. Moving forward, the next 10, 20, 30, 50 years may be about what technology is doing for the economy, but also doing to American workers. And we're going to have to figure out how do we train people to take the jobs that will persist. And there's some crazy public policy ideas floating out there. Stuff like Mr. Gates, Bill Gates, suggested a robot tax, something a former U.S. Treasury Secretary didn't like. We talked to him. There's also the idea that maybe we figure out ways that many more people can have a stake in the stock market so that when the robots increase the profits of a company by increasing productivity, even though that might hurt your wages, at least your stock portfolio will go up. So we take a look at some of these in the Robot Proof Jobs series, but that's not for a couple weeks, that part of it.
All right. Well, I'm going to be waiting for all of it with bated breath because you know this is right up my alley. Thank you, David.
You got it.
This final note before we go. It is, as I mentioned at the top of our program, March 31st. But careful consumers of the internet probably noticed that brands, capital B brands, are rolling out jokes today. Tricks, friendly hoaxes, Easter eggs, the kind of thing you usually associate with April 1st. That's right, the internet's most annoying fake news holiday falls on a Saturday this year. So apparently companies like Hulu, Google, T-Mobile, and way too many others are pushing to get their April 1st hoaxes out before close of business. Okay, are we over this now? And that is our show. Happy Friday, everyone. It was a down day to a great quarter. The Dow fell 65 points, the NASDAQ fell 2 points, and the S&P 500 lost 5 points, or 0.2%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Litterman. Marketplace is produced by Nancy Fargali, although it was Tommy Andres this week. Satara Nieves is the executive producer. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president. I'm Molly Wood. Kai Rizdahl is back on Monday. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.